This is the Press Pass with Chris Ryan.
This is where you hear unique conversations with the best athletes, coaches, and general managers in sports.
I think you appreciate each and every one. Each and every one is special in their own way. And
I play with two guys that they were on top of their game on a nightly basis, and people get spoiled. You know, they saw Manny, they saw David, so they start taking people for granted.
An opportunity for me. I know I need to help my team now, so you know, the better I play, the better it'll be for us.
I think it's one of the most important things is focus and consistency.
Well, the Boston Bruins season came to a close much earlier than expected. I am Chris Ryan. This is the Press Pass. I thought the Bruins had at least another round in them after they would dispatch the Islanders in this second round series, but that was not the case. The Boston Bruins lose 4-2, lose game 6 on the island, 6-2 after losing in games 4 and 5, so losing 3 in a row to finish the series. To me, the Bruins actually kind of lost this game in game 2, where they were really good in game 1. They had the momentum of the crowd being back for the first time in full capacity and losing in overtime in game 2. I thought this was kind of where the series turned, to be honest with you. There were another number of other key factors as to why the Bruins lost. I thought depth was an issue. The Bruins certainly had more top-end talent, if you will. But the depth of the third and fourth lines of the second and third defensive pairs, I thought those were really key. And the Bruins were careless with the puck. They made a lot of dumb mistakes and decisions were made with the puck, while the Islanders were very careful and did not turn it over. And some of the Bruins' mistakes ended up in their own net. Tuukka bailed them out on some. And I thought the goaltending was better for the Islanders as well. Like, I still look at this and say, I think the Bruins were a better team, but the Islanders certainly played a lot better in this series. And with this loss comes another year in which this core fails to win a second Stanley Cup to further cement their legacy. They've been to the Cup Finals 3 times, but have only won once. I talked with Brad Marchand and Patrice Bergeron after the Bruins lost Game 6.
Hey, first for Brad, just your thoughts on where you guys fell short in this series and what stands out to you. Is there also kind of a shock that things have ended this soon, where you thought perhaps a long run was coming up?
Yeah, it's disappointing. We expected a longer run in this room. You know, we felt like we had a group that could go really deep this year. You know, I think that it just came down to a couple of breaks. They capitalized on a few opportunities that they got, and you know, we didn't on the other end. So, you know, I think there's some games that we really outplayed them and came up short. But that's playoffs. Things like that happen.
And Patrice, just, you know, the window for this group, and you've obviously played with Brad for so long, and Krejci and Rask, and their future's somewhat up in the air at this point. How much does that kind of weigh on you at this point?
I mean, it does, you know, in a way. You know, that core is getting older one year to the next, and it's disappointing that way, you know, that you have a good team, you have, you know, opportunities, and you know they don't come that often, especially later in your career, and you want to make the most of them. So yeah, it's you know, you take it a year at a time, and now we'll see what happens.
The mental side of sports has always fascinated me, and I was curious as to the mindset that Brad Marchand had going into Game 6 and this kind of do-or-die scenario for the Bees with the legacy piece on the line as well. And I was interested in his thoughts at how you go about approaching that and trying to maximize your ability to have a great game, which he did with 2 goals in this contest, really the only Bruin that showed up and played to his full capability. But I wanted to get his take on the mental side. We talked about that pregame.
Hey, Brad. How do you maximize, you know, this moment from a mental standpoint where, as you mentioned, you know, there's so much on the line for this group? How do you put yourself in a place where you don't press an environment like this and you can create an environment for you and the group where you have success?
I think the biggest thing is just not overthinking it. You know, it's one game, and You know, you can't think about everything else that comes with that. It's just, it's one game. We've prepared for this a million times, and you know, we all know what we have to do to get ready to play our best. And that's all we can do is leave our best effort on the ice, and you know, whatever happens, happens. But you know, when we come prepared to play, we're a good team, and we're going to give ourselves a chance. But again, there's so many different factors that goes into to team winning that you can't control. So hopefully they all go our way tonight.
Unfortunately, they did not for the Bruins, and Bruce Cassidy was infuriated by the officiating after Game 5, and his comments to me and other reporters ended up getting him fined $25,000, and his hope was that he'd get some calls in Game 6, and certainly that did not come to fruition for the Bruins. Here is Bruce Cassidy post-game, Game 5, about how the Bruins didn't get any calls throughout the course of this series and really through the postseason.
Hey, Butchie, just connecting some of the dots there on the officiating and how well you think your team is playing, do you feel that it's having a tangible effect on the outcomes, given that the effort the boys are putting in and the type of series they've played, and not having it come to fruition on the scoreboard?
Well, today it did. There's no doubt it did. Now, we've got to kill the penalties. I've said that all along. Right? There's a call, and then there's the 2 minutes that you've got to kill the penalties. And I just spoke to it. We broke down. We need to be better on the penalty kill. We have all year. Below, from the blue line back today, wasn't our best. You know, when we broke down, we've gotten the saves in the past. Tonight, that didn't happen. You know, our penalty kill was good all year. So there's no reason to think it won't get better. It was great against Washington, but it needs to do it in a hurry. And again, some of that is personnel. So does it have an effect? You've got to put it out of your head. You just feel that, you know, deep down, like some of the guys are like, Jesus, you know, I'm getting the same treatment and we're going to the box. So mentally it could get you, but we can't allow it to. At the end of the day, you asked me the question, I answered it. We try not to ever bring it up in the room because it's something out of our control. We try to talk about, okay, what's in front of us? What can we control? And that's that. And that's all we've ever done. And that's what we'll continue to do. And maybe Game 6 will be our day where we get the calls that go our way. Maybe not. I don't know. I can't look into the future. We'll be ready to play. It's do or die for us, so we better be ready to play.
David Pastrnak also thought the officials were the reason the Bruins lost Game 5 in large part.
Hey, Pasta, just define the mood of the boys at this point in time after this game, a game where it felt like, you know, you played well enough to win but had a lot of things that didn't go your way. Where, what's your sense as to where you're at, where the guys are at after this one?
Always frustrating, you know. Wish we would have 5-10 more minutes, you know, to tie it. It's frustrating, but, you know, I'm going to let it go. And the main focus is get ready for Game 6. How I said, I think we've been the better team, but, you know, just didn't go our way today. So, how I said, just let it go and refocus.
Is there a concern at all about the officiating getting into your heads a little bit? Butchie was talking about that, where it feels like calls are going against you that aren't going, you know, aren't getting called on them. How do you kind of put that out of your mind and play the game when there seems to be such a disparity in officiating?
Yeah, I think first period, you know, they've been kind of letting it go both ways. And then second period, you know, I think there was some calls that were made, which is absolutely fine, you know, if it's going to go both ways. Obviously, didn't feel like we were getting same calls or the easy hooks and high sticks. There's plenty of they could call our way. They didn't, you know. It's pretty much all I can say. Don't want to get really much deeper than that. But obviously, I think, you know, if you're going to call those, the first two penalties, you know, you're going to call it both ways.
Bruins have a number of key decisions to make. Tuukka Rask, David Krejci, both at the end of their contracts and perhaps their time in Boston. Cam Neely has mentioned he would like to have them both back and expects that they will be back, but certainly there's a chance they do not return. There's also unrestricted free agent Taylor Hall, who was great for the Bruins throughout his time in Boston after being acquired at the trade deadline and also had a solid playoff run as well. I talked with Taylor Hall about his 200-foot game and why this fit for him as he looks to stay in Boston moving forward.
Hey, Taylor, your 200-foot game has been really strong with the Bruins. Has there been more of a focus on your part on that 200-foot game, or has that just been something that's always been there but has not been necessarily realized as much?
I've always tried to play like this. You know, probably my early days in Edmonton, I didn't have the just the knowledge of a 200-foot game there. But when I got to Jersey, that was how we had to play as a team. And being one of the better players in that team, that was my way of leading, was to play a 200-foot game. And obviously, it's never going to be perfect, but I have a pretty good skill set to do that on the other end of the rink. You know, I can chase down guys in the neutral zone and make their life hard. In the D zone, I can close quick on my D-man and make good plays on the wall, and that's really all I try to do. You know, since I've gotten here, our team plays a really good defensive style, and I've just had to adapt to that. But I've always tried to play well defensively. I'm not sure if that's been my reputation, but I always come into games, you know, no one wants to be on the ice for goals against, and everyone wants to play in the O zone. And the best way to do that is to you know, eliminate plays in your D zone, get out of there quickly, and go play in the fun zone, which is obviously the offensive zone.
Has that commonality that you have with Krejci and Berge and Marshy in that mindset, has that made things even more enjoyable with the Bruins to find guys that think that same way and to approach the game from a similar perspective?
Yeah, of course. You know, these guys are pros. They've done it for a long time. You know, Berge and Marsh, obviously elite penalty killers, 5-on-5. You see how they can stifle basically any line they play against. And I feel like Krejci is pretty underrated there as well. You know, he's a big reason why we're able to play well in the D zone as well. He's the guy down low doing the hard work, getting pucks up to us. You know, he's always back checking 200 feet. You know, you never see Smitty or I having to play center in our D zone because Krejci is always back there. So, you know, they're our leaders. They lead by example. And I think everyone follows along because they see how hard they do it at, you know, in the D zone. And obviously the O zone is where their skill takes over.
Now the Patriots, where OTAs will be coming to a close here soon and minicamp will begin. I talked with Patriots head coach Bill Belichick about what he looks to gain and what he is hoping to do in terms of educating, particularly the young players, the rookies. Mac Jones, we're going to hear from in just a bit during the minicamp time period. Morning, Bill. Whether it's with Mac or with any of the rookies coming in, how important in your view is this time period, the OTAs and the minicamp, to get them up to speed? And how do you determine whether or not they are picking up what you want to pick up, or how do you evaluate, you know, if you're putting too much on them, et cetera, during this time period in which they're trying to grow?
Yeah, well, it's hard to set up a teaching schedule for, you know, an individual player. You know, you set up your teaching and installation in a progressive way, a pyramiding way, so that you lay a strong foundation and, build up from there. You build up for the entire team. You can't just, gear towards one guy or gear towards another guy. Some players, you know, are going to be at the right pace. Some players are going to be a little behind that pace. Some players with experience may be a little ahead of that pace. And then each position coach can kind of tailor that to the individual that he's working with and where they are in that progression. So guys that have less experience or are behind for whatever reason, you try to, the position coach and sometimes other veteran players will try to, help that person with additional film time or classroom time or whatever it is, particularly if a player's not on the field practicing. If he's on the field practicing, then, he's able to use those practice reps to work on whether it's an individual fundamental skill or a team concept, the execution of a play and that type of thing. So there are a lot of different ways that a player learns and progresses. And for some players that are advanced, a lot of times you take them and work on something that's very specific to what they do that maybe the other players at that position don't do, and try to work on some, on things that would really help them and improve their play that we may not get to for a while. But if they can improve their individual skill, then when we come to those plays and those techniques, they'll be more proficient at them. So there's a general overall, you know, learning progression and structure that gets modified for each individual by the position coach, and ultimately try to put the player in a position where he can go out and compete and practice and show us what he can do. And then that can lead, if that's done well and done at a high enough level, then that would give the player an opportunity to compete in preseason or, you know, game situations. Some players, for whatever reason, may not practice as well as they play. Some players may not play as well as they practice. Practice and games aren't the same. I mean, there's a degree of carryover, certainly, but some players play and react and take the, and are able to utilize the physical nature of football to change or improve their performance differently than what you see in a practice setting. So it all adds up. It all helps the player's progression. The evaluation ultimately comes in competitive situations, and we're not really in those yet. In fact, we're quite a ways from them. So guys will go out and they'll, like all of us would do, first time you do something, make a mistake, not do it correctly, learn from it, go out and maybe pretty good at it. So it's hard to evaluate people off of just, you know, one or two opportunities of doing something. But over time that accumulates, and the more information you have, the more opportunities you have to evaluate how a player is doing, how he's progressing, whether he's leveling off, whether he's his improvement is spiking or maybe gradually inclining, then, you know, more time you have, the more better chance you have of being right on those evaluations. And then, of course, there's a lot of other factors that come into it as well that could be relevant. So we're not really in the evaluation process at this moment. We're in the teaching and trying to get the team to a point where we can compete against each other and in preseason against our preseason opponents or joint practices or whatever the case might be. And then we'll, those will be the real evaluation periods.
Thanks.
Next question, yeah, Andrew Callahan, followed by Doug Kite.
Hey, good morning, Bill.
Andrew.
So Ron Rivera mentioned the other day that he had brought in what he called a vaccine expert to speak.
Here is the aforementioned Mac Jones. Hey, Mac. Earlier today, Bill Belichick was talking about how it's difficult to evaluate at this point in time because there's no real outside competition. For you, how do you go about self-evaluating and, you know, trying to determine where you are and where you need to get to? As you mentioned, there's some of those ups and downs. How do you self-evaluate?
I mean, you just can't have too high of an expectation and put too much pressure on yourself. And like I said, I'm very hard on myself, but, you know, you got to stack good plays together and keep moving forward. So I have to be able to do it faster and have to be more confident and be louder. And that will come with reps. So every day I'm just trying to get better and learn from the guys that are already have done it and have been through it. So it's, you know, the two buckets, you know, you have two buckets and one of them is good, one of them is bad. And you got to improve on the bad and keep the good in the good. So it's pretty much how I'm going about it.
So last weekend, the Red Sox swept away the Yankees before having a disappointing series and losing to the Houston Astros. And I asked Alex Cora if he feels that Yankees-Red Sox has lost a lot of the luster, particularly from the time period that he played.
Alex, what is your sense on the Red Sox-Yankees rivalry at this point? I mean, you were talking before the series about the games being long and it kind of being like a divisional type of setup, particularly compared to when you played. Like, what is the sense of what the rivalry is at this point?
I think there were more characters, you know, when I play. It was fun, obviously, you know, with David and Manny coming here and doing their thing. Nothing against this beautiful facility, but the feeling in the other one was a lot different. I was actually telling Enrique 2 days ago how he was at the old stadium. You know, I think we had the first fight yesterday towards the end of the game. Back in the day, that was, I mean, by the second game, the eighth inning of the second game, there were like probably 25 fights already. And obviously, it's different because it's not at full capacity. But the fans were loud yesterday. They were into it. It's just fun. It's always good. I think, like I said, the players are different. The characters are different. But at the end, it's still Yankees, Red Sox, and people watch.
Yankees come into Fenway Park for the first time this year, last weekend in June. Red Sox have struggled against the Houston Astros this year. They're the only team that has hit the Red Sox pitching staff consistently well and also shut down the Boston Red Sox. I talked with Nathan Eovaldi about that.
Nate, the Astros have really been the only team that have had a lot of success against this pitching staff this year. And has it been their approach in being aggressive early on? What kind of stands out to you about why they may have had this success?
You know, it's my first time facing them this year. I think it's the, you know, their approach. You know, they got guys who don't really swing and miss that much. You know, they put the ball in play. They make things happen. You know, they have power up and down their lineup as well. But I think just for us, it's attacking the zone better. You know, having quality pitches. You know, you fall behind certain guys in their lineup and they're able to do damage. And, you know, even Correa, some of his at-bats, you know, he was able to take a walk when he needed to. And he was able to get a couple base hits off me when he needed to as well. So, you know, I just feel like I got to make a better, do a better job of adjusting on the fly.
It's been a great year for Red Sox closer Matt Barnes, and I talked with him about the pitching staff as a whole and what has led to his success.
Matt, can you describe what your confidence is like at this point this year? And, you know, what does it feel like to have that type of whip where you're coming in and you know there's a good chance that your stuff's going to play well and is going to be dominant?
Yeah, you know, definitely confident. And obviously, when you have success and you throw the ball well, that confidence can, you know, kind of continues to stay with you. Obviously easier than when you're failing. But, you know, I totally changed my mindset coming into this year, as, you know, kind of as I explained to you guys earlier in the season, where I just trust my stuff wholeheartedly. I trust that. And I think the biggest thing is trusting my fastball in the zone this year. I trust that I can throw my fastball to any hitter in any count, at any part of the zone, and kind of have the same confidence as that as I have always had in my curveball, especially in hitters counts. And I think that's allowed me to be more competitive in the zone, not only early in the counts, but when I get behind in the counts, as opposed to kind of getting a little precise, I guess is the word. And dance around the zone a little bit. Now, obviously, there's going to be certain situations like the other night. If I fall behind, right, I try to make two good pitches to Aaron Judge, miss with the fastball barely on both of them. But when I get into a true hitter's count with a big power hitter in a one-run game, obviously, I'm going to be smart there. But I feel good. You know, the guys around me are throwing the ball well, so it makes you want to continue to go and continue to push. And the team's playing well, so definitely confident in not only myself, but in this team that we have.
Just on your sense of the team as well, you know, both Christian and JD have talked on the offensive side about how there's that type of 2018 feel. Pitching yep. staff is obviously a huge part of 18 too. Maybe you don't have the big names that team did, but what is your sense about what the pitching staff is in terms of how it can compete for a championship?
Yeah, I think we have to just continue to do what we're doing. You know, I don't know the exact numbers, but I think that we've got to be one of the better pitching staffs in the league, in terms of numbers and whatever you want to measure that by. But yeah, you know, it might not be David Price and Rick Porcello, but But I mean, Garrett Richards and Martin Perez and Nick Pivetta, I mean, you go out there and watch these guys throw, and they've got all electric shit, and they command the ball really well in the zone and keep hitters off balance. Our bullpen is, you know, it's the same thing. You know, we've got guys who have been here for a little while now, guys with electric stuff. Obviously some guys who have played in big games. So I'm completely confident in this team and in what this pitching staff can accomplish. And you know, it doesn't hurt when you've got Chris Sale on the up and up and hopefully with us sooner, obviously, rather than later.
This is the Press Pass. I am Chris Ryan. Boston Red Sox enter play on Saturday with a record of 39-25, one game off the pace of Tampa Bay Rays for the top spot in the AL East. Red Sox with one of the best winning percentage in baseball at this point in time as well. Only a couple teams with a better winning percentage. One would be the San Francisco Giants, who have the best in baseball, then the Tampa Bay Rays, then the Chicago White Sox. It's the Red Sox with the fourth best win percentage in the bigs at this point in time. One of the reasons why, comebacks. Red Sox have come from behind 23 times this year. Their biggest comeback of the season came on Friday night as they trailed 5-1 in the sixth after Vladdy Jr. blasted a ball from Sawamura over the monster, and that put the Blue Jays up 5-1. Red Sox then went to work in the bottom of the sixth. Tyler Chatwood had one of the worst relief appearances I've ever seen. Walked a couple dudes, hit a couple dudes, and he was gone. Score got closer. Red Sox were able to tie it with a Christian Arroyo home run in the eighth and win it with a walk-off double from Alex Verdugo in the ninth, 6-5. Let's hear right now from Doogie on the walk-off. Alex, you've been waiting for this type of, you know, moment at Fenway Park, and you talked about having the fans there. What was it like to actually experience that moment and everything that comes with a walk-off?
It was amazing. I mean, it was something special for sure. You know, it's one of those things, just when you're at the box, you try your best to, like, you know, calm down, you know, take deep breaths, relax, whatever. But when you have 25, 30,000 people screaming and yelling and jumping up and down, it's a little hard to kind of get that tunnel vision, but at the same time, you know, it's amazing because your heart starts racing, everything feels good. You're not, you know, what was sore before isn't sore at that moment. You're just kind of locked in. So it was very, very special, very fun. And yeah, to top off this and get the W was huge.
How important do you think are all those different approaches and mentalities and kind of emotional states in putting together a team and having all these come from behind victories to kind of have a whole bunch of different individuals with different mindsets?
I think it's very important. You know what I mean? Just because it's 162 games playing every single day. It's, you know, at certain points it can become a drag. So, you know, just when you have these guys, you know, these Kikes with a lot of energy, a lot of, you know, really good clubhouse guy, you know, and some people who are kind of a little bit more serious and you know, kind of goofy and all these things. And some, so it's just, I just feel like it helps everybody kind of stay loose, stay relaxed, and just know, like, you know, like I said, next man up, next guy's got it. So it's just, you know, we all work well with each other. We all understand each other in jail.
Here is Christian Arroyo. 23rd come from behind win for you guys this year, down 5-1 in this game. Why do you think this team is able to pull off this many come from behind victories? What about this group allows for that to take place?
Honestly, I just think it's we just believe in our entire lineup. I mean, I know it's cliche to say because I think everyone believes in their team, but I truly believe that there's in every single game, for the most part, we're in every game. That 5-1 lead there, all we wanted to do, yeah, it might have felt like we were down a little bit in the dugout and this and that, but all we wanted to do was put guys on base and make things happen, keep the line moving like we've been saying since day one and even in spring training. So once we keep the line moving and we're able to take our walks and take our base hits the other way and not get too big, I mean, good things happen. So, I mean, a shout out to our entire lineup today. It's a grind, but it's part of it, and we're winning ball games, and that's what matters.
Just your feeling on hitting that home run as well, that was no cheapie by any stretch of the imagination. What did it feel like, and what did Fenway feel like in that moment where that was really your first, not your first big Fenway moment, but a big Fenway moment?
I mean, it's pretty unparalleled to anything I've ever experienced in baseball in my entire life. I think that the Red Sox Nation is easily the greatest fans in baseball. It's just different. It's hard to explain. Obviously last year, getting to play here for the first time in the Red Sox uniform with no fans was surreal, but at the same time, you just don't get that same, you don't get that same feeling. And even at the beginning of the year when we were limited capacity, and by no means is this a diss on anyone, but it's just different, when it's not 100%. Now that we're 100% and there's people in the stands and it's rocking, it's like, that sixth inning there when we were getting stuff rolling and we put up three runs in that inning, it was like every single pitch, my ears were ringing. And that stuff's awesome. So to me, I love it. I enjoy every moment of it. I love how loud everyone is and how everyone gets into it. Obviously, Sweet Caroline, just one of those cool things. Now I can experience personally on the home side with fans in the stands. But, it's pretty surreal.
Garrett Richards threw 38 pitches in the first inning. He gave up three runs through the first two, and it looked like his outing was going to be really, really short. He's going to throw 100 pitches no matter what because the Sox bullpen was in a bit of a dire straits circumstance. But was that 100 pitches going to be over like three or four innings? Instead, he was able to make it to the sixth. Garrett, how much pride do you take in how you did battle tonight after 38 pitches in the first inning and extending to get to, five and a third? And did anything change for you after that first inning?
I mean, like I said, I knew that I was going to be out there for 100 pitches based on how our bullpen was. So, I either was going to fold or I was going to try and make the best out of what was going on. So, sitting down in the dugout in between innings, these are the things that go through my mind. And, I'm getting older now and I just want to win. I don't really care about my personal stats. I'm more interested in us winning every game that we play and ultimately winning a World Series. I'm 33 years old. I'm not going to get in the Hall of Fame, so I don't really care about my personal stats. I just want us to win every single night. So that's my main focus.
Also, Chris Sale's return seems to be on the horizon. He threw off the mounds at Fenway yesterday. But the timetable, whether he's going to start, whether he's going to relieve, that's still very much up in the air. Of course, Sale has been not able to pitch in the big leagues for the last 13 months after Tommy John surgery shut down just prior to COVID in 2020 down in spring training.
Chris, can you describe what the last 15 months have been like from a competitor's standpoint? Because obviously you're one of the most competitive people most individuals have been around. And has it been difficult to stick with the process given how you want to compete and want to be there from a mental standpoint?
Yes. This is definitely the hardest challenge I've ever had in my life because it's, the train has been moving for 25 years of my life, and this is the first time it's actually ever stopped. There was definitely an adjustment period. I definitely had to lock it in and be focused on what the goal at the time is. At the beginning of this, kind of in the middle of it, I kind of set my sights a little bit too far and things kind of started rolling on me a little bit. And it's tough. Rehab is different for everybody, and I don't think anybody is going to say it's rainbows and butterflies every day, but like I said, there's good days, there's bad days, and you take them as they come and you roll on to the next one.
Have you envisioned what the day is going to be like when you return to the mound? Like, do you feel like it's going to be like your first start? Do you feel like it's going to be our first appearance? Do you feel like it's going to be something different in that you've had time away from the game, and maybe, you know, you'll, I'm not saying you took things for granted, but you'll have like a different perspective. You know what I'm saying?
100%. I can already tell my, like, I appreciate what I do on a daily basis more than I ever have in my life, whether it's, you know, coming here and doing shoulder program, which I don't know, I've never heard of a pitcher that actually likes doing shoulder program, but just appreciating the fact that I get to do it, being able to throw the way I've been able to throw the last few months. And yeah, it's not going to be some big ceremonial game. You know, it's we're either going to win it or we're going to lose it. I'm going to pitch good. I'm going to pitch bad. I'm going to pitch all right. It's not like this is going to be some highlighted start in my career. It's just, I'm going to do everything I can to make it be as normal as possible. Sure, the first couple pitches, I'm sure, will be amped up. But, you know, once you get through the first handful of pitches of a game, then you just kind of settle in and go with it.
It's the Press Pass. I'm Chris Ryan. This is the Press Pass. I am Chris Ryan. Red Sox continue a three-game series against the Toronto Blue Jays, their AL East rival. Blue Jays have some of the most exciting young players in baseball. One of them is an individual who is the leading candidate for MVP at this point in time. 22-year-old Vladimir Guerrero Jr., of course, lit the Eastern League on fire and the country with his play in the minor leagues. And, of course, doing so with the New Hampshire Fisher Cats. We'll hear from him in just a moment as I caught up with him at Fenway Park on Friday night as in-person interviews have returned. Got your vaccination card, you wear a mask, you go down on the field and talk to the players once again if you are a media member and took advantage of that. We'll hear from Vladimir Guerrero Jr. via his interpreter in just a moment. Also coming up next week, conversations with Kike Hernandez and Bo Bichette, the former Fisher Cat and Blue Jay shortstop. But first, we're going to hear from Alex Cora on the bounce-back season from J.D. Martinez. J.D. is once again the best DH in baseball. Once again, the Red Sox most consistent hitter. Alex, do you feel like J.D.'s been your most consistent hitter this year? And how do you feel that helps Bogey and also Devers to have him hit the way that he has, taking some pressure off of them perhaps?
I don't know, because those two guys hit last year and JD didn't do much. Just put us in a better spot offensively. You guys know the address here at Fenway, so you guys can send me that dollar that I bet, you know, in spring training that he was going to have a better season. Now, all joking aside, it's not only what he does on the field, it's what he does in the cage and in the meetings. And I asked Rafi not too long ago, I want to say less than 10 days, how JD acted last year in the clubhouse, in the meetings, in the cage. And he's like, Alex, he worked harder than what he's working right now. And I know people talk about video and the big difference, but I just feel like he, you know, I don't think that's the case of him, you know, the difference this year between this year and last year. I think it's more about physically where he was last year. And he was honest about it, but, that's why we signed him in 18, right? To be that guy in the middle of the lineup to help everybody else, driving runs, be on base. And right now he's driving in runs and he's scoring a lot of runs. And, you know, he's been amazing since day one during the season. He's driving the ball. Even when he's not hitting the ball out of the ballpark, he keeps the line moving. And, you know, I'm happy for him because I know it was a hard season last year. It was a harder off season with everybody, the way they were talking about him, and the fact that he's competing at this level and doing it like this, it's been great. It's been fun to watch.
J.D. Martinez is in fact back, hitting .311 with 13 home runs and 41 RBI. Individual who is definitely making his mark in the big leagues right now is former New Hampshire Fisher Cat Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Vladdy Jr. not only had three big hits for the Blue Jays on Friday night, but that's been what he has done consistently throughout the course of the year. His stats are flat-out MVP caliber. .336, 19 home runs, and 50 RBI. His OPS is 1.106, OBP 442. He is having a tremendous impact on the game. You know, the only other MVP candidate who is out there that could beat Vladimir Guerrero in the American League would be Shohei Ohtani. Ohtani, of course, pitches and hits really well. 17 home runs is 2 off the pace from Vladdy and only 5 off the pace in terms of RBI. So, I mean, if I'm voting, Shohei Ohtani is kind of the MVP every year, considering that he pitches every 5 days and is a really solid hitter. But Vladimir Guerrero Jr. certainly has a stake and a claim to the MVP slot. And Vladdy Jr. is still only 22 years of age. And he's coming off a season last year in which he didn't hit the way that he wanted. He was one of those guys that was kind of below where he wanted to be in that shortened season. 262, 9 home runs, and 33 RBI after a really strong initial campaign in 2019, but has slimmed up and turned things around. I talked with Vladdy Jr. via his interpreter at Fenway on Friday.
Vladdy, obviously this has been an MVP caliber season for you. What have been some of the big reasons why you think that things have gone so well for you this year?
El momento ha sido una temporada, ¿verdad? Candidato más valioso y todo te ha salido bien. ¿Qué tú crees que han sido las razones por las cuales está luciendo tan bien?
Bueno, yo creo que llegar temprano a trabajar, confiar en mi trabajo, ¿me entiendes? Confiar en mi coach y seguir trabajando fuerte para ponerle al equipo a ganar.
Just being, like I always say, just being here early, do my routine, trusting myself, trusting my team and my coaches, and just keep doing what I'm doing.
There's been a lot of discussion about the type of shape that you're in this year, and that's been a big factor in what's allowed for you to have success. Do you see it that way, or has it been more just this is kind of your destiny, so to speak, and it was a matter of time to get into this point?
Obviamente la razón que se comenta y se ha dicho mucho que la razón también porque te está yendo bien por la pérdida de peso también forma. ¿Tú también lo ves de esa manera o tú simplemente que ese es el destino, que así es que te tocó y este era el año que te tocaba?
Bueno, yo creo que no solamente la pérdida de peso, sino el trabajo que yo puse en la temporada muerta, ¿me entiendes? El trabajo fuerte, el trabajo todos los días, ¿me entiendes? El no descansar, y yo creo que eso es lo que está saliendo ahora y gracias a Dios me siento muy bien, en salud y seguir trabajando.
I mean, basically, I think not just that I lose a lot of weight. I mean, like I always say, I work very, very hard in the off season, and it pretty much is just paying off right now.
Was there any doubt that, particularly last year, was there any doubt that this type of a season was going to come? Obviously, even the best players struggle with confidence at points in time. Was there ever a point where you were struggling to the point like, is this going to happen for me?
Los mejores jugadores pues, tienen un momento que, ¿verdad? Que falla un poco y las dudas existen. ¿Tuviste alguna duda en algún momento el año pasado de que esto no iba a suceder, lo que te está sucediendo ahora?
No, nunca, ¿me entiendes? Nunca dejé de confiar en mí, de confiar en mi coach, de confiar en cada uno de nosotros, ¿me entiendes? Y yo creo que trabajando fuerte se logra y gracias a Dios se está logrando.
Never doubt on myself. I mean, I always trust on myself. Like I said, I trust my teammate, trust my coaches. I just work very, very, very hard, but never doubt on myself.
What, in your view, are the biggest parts of your approach that allow for you to have such success? Like, you obviously understand the game to a large degree, but is there something specific in your approach that you think allows for you to have success, whether it's reading the pitcher, the type of work you put in before the game? What do you point to?
¿A qué tú le atribuyes, verdad, el éxito que estás teniendo en el plato? ¿Es más conociendo los picheos, el trabajo que pones antes del juego? Obviamente, pues tú tienes una habilidad pues, que no todos tienen, pero ¿verdad? ¿A qué tú le atribuyes ese éxito?
Bueno, yo creo que el trabajo del hitting coach, de Guillermo, de Hodgins, ¿me entiendes? Cada día siempre tenemos un plan, cada día venimos aquí temprano a hacer un plan y confiando en Dios y confiando en mí, en los compañeros que vienen detrás de mí también, confiar en ellos, en que ellos puedan hacer un buen trabajo igual que yo también.
Definitely the work that I put in before the games with my hitting coaches, Guillermo Martinez, Dave Hodgins. I mean, we came here early, we go about our routine, and I mean, it has to be that, and obviously God, I mean, I want to thank God for that, my teammates, everybody that trusted me for the way I'm feeling and I'm doing right now.
A lot of players will push back on being a home run hitter. They'll say, you know what, I want to be a line drive hitter. I want to spray the ball to all fields. Do you embrace being a home run hitter? Is that something that you want to be known as, a guy that can lead the league in home runs like you are now?
¿Verdad? Muchos jugadores pues siempre se consideran bateadores de línea, otros de jorrones, otros de darle la bola para todos lados. En el caso tuyo, que estás liderando la línea en jorrones, ¿tú te consideras, eso es lo que tú quieres ser, te consideras un jorronero?
Bueno, como te digo, yo llego aquí y solamente trato de darle la bola duro, ¿me entiendes? No pienso en dar jonrón, en hacer cosas, ¿me entiendes? Si la bola sale, sale, gracias a Dios, pero solamente trato de darle la bola duro a la maceta y darle duro para atrás.
To be honest with you, I never think about homers. The only thing in my mind when I go out there is just to try to put a solid contact. Hit the ball in front and trying to do the much I can. If the ball goes out, it goes out.
Last thing is just on the trajectory of this team. Obviously, you guys have been dealing with some injuries. Springer's been out the whole year. Do you like where this team is headed, the moves in the offseason, and also the challenge of playing in this division where the Red Sox are reloaded, again, the Yankees are the Yankees, and obviously the Rays are at the top of things?
Hablando del equipo, la situación del equipo un poco, obviamente, pues, hemos batado muchas lesiones, Springer no ha podido jugar. La situación de jugar en una división, pues los Boston pues, se preparó mejor, los Yankees son los Yankees, Tampa pues está, ¿verdad? Tampa. ¿Cómo ves la situación de nosotros a pesar de, ¿verdad?, de las firmas y hicieron que hicimos los season? ¿Cómo ves el equipo ahora mismo?
Bueno, como te digo, cada equipo tiene su alta y su baja, ¿me entiendes? Pero estamos bien, yo creo que estamos bien, seguimos compitiendo, todavía faltan 3 meses por jugar y yo creo que nunca hemos bajado la guardia, seguimos compitiendo y seguimos saliendo al terreno a ganar.
I mean, like I say, everything has its ups and downs. I mean, we're going to go out there and we're going to continue competing. I know we have a good team. I mean, we're never going to put our heads down. We're going to keep working very hard as a team. And then whenever we get everybody back, I think we're in a good position to keep playing very good. And we'll see what happens.
Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Vladimir Guerrero Jr., one of the top players in baseball. You've been listening to the Press Pass. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Chris Ryan.